And back in World War II, where Pacifica began. But here in Germany, with a brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl. They weren't Jewish, they were German Christians. And they, together with their professor and other students and workers, decided to form the White Rose Collective. And they thought the best they could do was put out pamphlets so that the Germans would never be able to say we didn't know. And in one of those pamphlets were written the words, "We will not be silent." They had these pamphlets distributed everywhere. Under cover of darkness, in schoolyards, marketplaces, alleyways, anywhere they could. And then Hans and Sophie and their professor were captured, they were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now.
You are listening to 90.7 KBOO Portland. Coming up next, we'll hear from former political prisoner Daniel McGowan. Daniel McGowan is a former member of the Earth Liberation Front who was convicted of the arsons of two Oregon-based lumber companies in 2001.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host Chris Hedges Friday, May 26th at 7 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Hedges takes a provocative look at the current state of revolt in the United States and will recount the U.S.'s continuing history of domestic terrorism while outlining ways for communities to resist before it's too late. Again, that's Chris Hedges, Friday, May 26th at 7 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Daniel McGowan spoke at Portland State University's Smith Student Union to a packed room on April 7, 2017. McGowan is an environmental and social justice activist who was arrested and convicted of arson and conspiracy relating to actions that took place in 2001. This was his first trip back to the Pacific Northwest since his sentencing in June 2007. Here's Daniel.
Thank you for coming out. It's really amazing to be back here. And I want to thank everyone that took time out of their life to come see me rant about stuff. I want to thank the people that put on this event, the RAD Education Group and the Student Animal Liberation Coalition here at PSU, as well as Amanda and Justin for putting it all together. I also want to thank Portland ABC and Oregon Jericho were in the back of the room with an excellent info table with information about prisoners and prisoner struggles. Thank you also KBOO for coming in and recording this. Appreciate that. It is really good to be back. I've spent some time in Portland throughout the years. Oregon's obviously a very loaded place for me. It's a place I lived for a few very active years of my life and ultimately where I was indicted, convicted, and sentenced. It's been a long time, and you know, anyone that's done time in prison will kind of tell you that time is a kind of a really strange thing. Like, you go away and you think everything's going to be different when you get out. And so my sense of timing, I was talking to my friend and I was like, "How long have you guys been together?" Like, and I'm thinking in my head it's like 4 years, and she's like 10. The thing about time is that I notice is like how the activist life cycle and political movements have like a very short timeline, and they spin, and after a while you start to see the same cycles happen and over, and you know, you want to think that that's good because like, yeah, I'm learning, you know, but then you watch like people coming into the movement and, you know, making the same exact mistakes, saying the same exact things that you said, thinking that they came up with the idea of resistance, as I did when I was I was like an insufferable new activist that just really, I just knew everything and blah, blah, blah. So people can in this room can definitely attest to that. I will say, though, that it's dawned on me that because this activist life cycle is so short, there used to come a time where every single person I met had some knowledge of my case. And so in the last year, it's kind of been interesting to see, like, especially in the wave of Trump, all these people come in and people be like, man, I kind of, you know, I know your name, I just don't. So I said to myself, like, it makes sense to, like, lay a little bit of a groundwork, you know, for what happened, to give people some perspective. You know, just because something's important in your life doesn't mean that people really know anything about it, right? Especially considering my point about the activist life cycle. And we're really bad, the left or whatever you want to consider it, at institutional knowledge and passing it on. And so we do have that reinvention of the wheel thing. So I'm sorry if you've heard some of this before, but I do think it makes sense to kind of just give a little bit of a background on it. I lived in Oregon for roughly 2 years, and while I did, I participated in a number of actions with the Earth Liberation Front, and our group was rather large, like 10 or more people. My personal focus at the time was stopping old-growth logging and working to stop the introduction of genetically modified organisms into the environment. There was, you know, a lot of activism. This was like, we're talking like late 90s, early 2000s. There was definitely a lot of activism on those topics. But I felt like there needed to be a more radical component to it. And the way I looked at it was like, I'm young. My like lifestyle was such that I felt like I could throw myself into things without a lot of caution. I went through a period of time where I was arrested many times for activism. I did civil disobedience, and I locked my arms into barrels, and like I climbed trees, and like, you know, I did a lot of different things in a very short period of time, and I kind of like burnt through a lot of the different tactics that our movements use, including some of the more mainstream ones like writing letters and lobbying and things like that back in New York. At this point, a few years into my activism career, it made a lot more sense to maybe avoid arrest. I had racked up like 12 arrests. Frankly, it was a bit of a drag, and I didn't, you know, I was using sort of a antiquated strategy of, oh, we're going to get arrested and we're going to stop things by getting arrested. And obviously, when you examine that belief, you know, 10 people getting arrested, you know, it's not going to slow down the system, but there is that thought process that you're going to like gum up the works or something. And that idea died. So I moved to Oregon, and I'm a city kid. I was seriously blown away by it, and blown away by just what I saw at the time as like a tepid response to it. And I, again, like, that's not exactly my perspective now, but at the time I was like, I just was stunned. I couldn't believe. And I couldn't really deal with like the destruction, and it really fueled rage in me. You know, fueled, it just contributed to it. So I spent roughly 2 years planning and researching, executing these actions on issues. We did a lot of different things. The government likes to talk about the arsons only because it's the most spectacular and frankly the most dangerous, but you know, sensational. We worked on a lot of different issues and did a lot of different things. We spiked trees, destroyed logging equipment, pulled survey stakes, destroyed machinery belonging to all different kinds of corporations. Eventually, I pleaded guilty to two large arsons. One was at Superior Lumber in Glendale, Oregon, and one was at Jefferson Poplar Farm in Klatskanai, which was previously owned by a large timber corporation that we suspected were engaged in GMO research of trees. And at a certain point, our group cleaved over ideological issues involving tactics, involving our relationship to the larger movement, and over interpersonal behavior of some of the people in our group. And I took my relationship with these people, with my fellow comrades, very seriously, and I pledged to them that, you know, should harm come our way, that my lips are sealed and I would do everything I can to help them out. So not everyone was attached to this promise as I was, as I found out in 2005. So I'm living in New York in 2005, and I was indicted, you know, out here. And they planned basically a very large arrest of 7 of us on the same day. I had been, you know, living in New York, living with the knowledge of what happened, but sharing it with no one. My partner at the time did not know, which you can imagine caused issues when I was arrested. You know, I felt hopeful, thinking it would never come up, but watching the activity after 9/11, it seemed the Department of Justice was on a path to indict people for old crimes. I saw friends of mine in Oregon with an excellent group that doesn't exist any longer called Break the Chains. doing support work for someone named Sarah Jane Olson, who was involved in the SLA 30 years ago. I saw a man named James Kilgore. He's actually released a really excellent book called Understanding Mass Incarceration a few years ago. But James Kilgore was also involved with the SLA, the Symbionese Liberation Army, a ultra-left group from the 70s. So James Kilgore was arrested and extradited to the United States and got a sentence. It seemed at the time to me, from my perspective in New York, living there after 9/11, that there was an abundance of money and, for the first time, really rampant coordination between agencies, which was new and a little scary. In this country, there are hundreds of thousands of unsolved murders, rapes, and assaults, but a 7-year-old arson or a 35-year-old bank robbery gone bad clearly was, in their opinion, worth dusting off if you have millions of dollars to pay the agents, and they suddenly have this newfound appreciation for working together to get the bad guys, which in our case, you know, was us. If you look at like what happened in Oregon after 9/11, the two major cases that they netted was finally solving the ELF case, which I say solve, but essentially someone just decided to talk, and then the Portland 7, which were seven people accused of attempting to get to a training facility, I believe, in Pakistan or Afghanistan, and so these people got material aid to support terrorism, essentially for not succeeding in getting to a training camp halfway around the world. So this is Oregon's contribution to the war on terror. It's pretty pathetic. I mean, not that it's not pathetic everywhere else, because everywhere else it's just entrapment cases and whatnot.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Join your friends and neighbors and become a member of this powerful radio community today. I'm Jenna, and I am here with Ruben, and you're listening during our spring membership drive on News and Public Affairs Day. My favorite day here at KBOO.
It sure is.
Yeah, because, I mean, if you tune into KBOO, you know that we are our volunteers here at KBOO, and we just... I don't know. Ooh, this is our favorite day because it's about us. It's about the newsroom. So give us a call if you support, because you do support. You're listening right now. So give us a call, 877-500-5266. Become a member today to support this, the type of program you're listening to right now. Again, that's 877-500-5266.
KBOO's public affairs and talk programs emphasize controversial and neglected perspectives on important local, national, and international issues, such as what we're playing right now about mm-hmm. Daniel McGowan. So these kind of stories are so important to bring to the public, and sure. These are the types of things that KBOO is all about.
Well, these are like the kind of stories that people want to just kind of forget about too, right? Yeah. They want to bury this kind of story. And look at what KBOO is bringing this to you.
Yeah, and we bring it to you as directly as we can. So that's why it's important for you to call 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-KBOO. Or you can go online at kboo.fm and click the donate button.
You know, maybe think about coming in at around, say, $10 a month. It's about $120 a year. And if maybe that's, you know, about, like we always say, about an hour's wage. If you can, you know, if you're employed right now and you can afford that right now, you can get the wonderful KBOO shirt that's also full of controversy because
awesome.
It has aliens on it. But it's just so reflective of our KBOO culture here, where we try to bring you not the average story. We try to bring you a deeper discussion. We try to bring you the controversy. We try to bring you the unique. We try to bring you the thought-provoking types of conversations that we need to be having at a time right now. You know, like when you think about Daniel McGowan, his story, you know, if you're new to Portland, is something that people don't really talk about, but is something that, you know, when it happened here, it was, if people remember, about a decade ago. I mean, I wasn't even here, but I do remember hearing about, oh, here's environmental terrorism. You know, but
yeah.
People didn't want to have that deeper discussion about what is this? What is this? And what are these people saying about the environment? So, you know, if you remember that discussion and you're enjoying that we're continuing this, because you're listening right now, give us a call, 877-500-5266. Again, just whip out that smartphone. It only takes a minute to become a member. 877-500-5266. Consider coming at that $10 a month. Support the type of programming you're listening to, or go online at kboo.fm and become a member today.
We return to a speech by Daniel McGowan, recorded April 7th. Now he's speaking about being arrested for the actions in 2001.
So ironically, I was working at an organization that provided resources for women surviving domestic violence when I was arrested. I had been in New York for 3 years, roughly, and I participated in a bunch of collectives organizing against the Republican National Convention, war against Iraq, and I worked on local projects with the New York City anarchist community. I coordinated support for Jeffrey Lures, along with a few Oregonians, and we had a large international day of action in 2004 with about 50 or so events worldwide. This week of action got a lot of attention, essentially, because the FBI sent out an eco-terrorist alert, which actually just helped us kind of with media, which was great. The day I was arrested seemed like pretty much like no other. I went to work, I helped stuff envelopes with our annual holiday card, and I made changes to the website. It was, you know, people always are like, oh, did you notice anything that day? And I was like, I didn't notice anything. I went about my day, and I got up after hearing some hubbub in like the reception area. I heard argument and my name, and I kind of just was, you know, you kind of know at that point like something's up. And so these two dudes come and they're standing in the doorway and, you know, like mustaches and beefy. And I'm just like, oh, that's a bad sign. And they're like, they asked me if I'm Daniel McGowan. And I'm thinking, don't lie, because, you know, I don't want to get busted for lying. But like, next thing I know, I mean, they knew. And so next thing I know, I'm just like stretched like a contortionist. Their law and order moment was being like, you're going back to Oregon. That was like the... That was law enforcement burn. And I, you know, of course, like, you know, if it was on TV, I would have been like, It was kind of ridiculous. They're really sneaky. They took my keys. They drove to Manhattan, where I had just been living with my partner. My neighbor, who's like the mayor of the block, was sort of like, what are you guys doing in there? Those are good kids. And just gave them the business. And they were like, it's a terrorism investigation, ma'am. And she's like, I know Jenny and I know them. And when I heard that, I was like, God, thank God for good people. Like, give them grief, you know. I was kept in a car parked in downtown Brooklyn right by a place called Cabin Plaza. It's where the Eastern District of New York Federal Court is. It's a really imposing building. It's the kind of building that when they're driving you into, you're just like, things are bad. They kept me there, and they didn't bring me to court. They gave me, like, the speech, you know. The U.S. attorney's in town. The door is going to be open for a brief while. Think about it, you know. You know what happened with Jeff Lures, you know. You know what happened with Chris McIntosh. He was an individual who... got charged with the same exact charge that I was going to get charged with, which had a mandatory 30-year sentence. It's called use of a destructive device. If you are charged with it as a non-terrorist, it has a 5-year mandatory minimum, which is bad enough. But if it's a terrorism crime, it's a 30. So they were like telling me, giving me the whole rundown of how long I would be in prison. And I had been involved in some prisoner support. It's obviously a little different to be in that seat myself, but I kind of knew. I've gone to enough know your rights trainings and legal trainings, and I got the like shut your mouth thing, really, because I'm like, you only get one chance at this, so just shut up. They put the heat on like so high, you know, and I'm just sitting there just burning up. The crazy thing about cops is like, as soon as you can assert your right to a lawyer, but as soon as you open up your mouth, that's over. You can say anything. They're talking to me about baseball and stuff, and I'm just sitting there looking out the window thinking about like my life. I told them I was represented. I picked a lawyer's name out of the air. It happened to be someone that was representing my friend who had got him a very good outcome. I spent a few days there. I was flown to Oregon with pit stops in various prisons and jails around the country. I ended up in Lane County for 2 months. My family graciously offered the houses they lived in as collateral on a bond. My co-defendant actually sadly took his own life when he was in county jail, and when that happened, all of us were taking and put in the hole and put on, like, I was actually put on suicide watch for 10 days because of my behavior of my co-defendant. So bonded out, I went home to New York City, threw myself into my legal defense. I annoyed my lawyers with phone calls all day long. I got my discovery sent to me. You know, at the time was foolishly thinking we were going to go to trial, because I was like, you know, I watched TV shows about crime, and I was, you know, I'm like an activist. I think I know something about the system. And I'm like, my lawyers are like, you know, going to trial with what these people are saying about you is like, you know, life plus a couple hundred years. And, you know, that obviously was an eye-opener. So we filed a lot of motions. We filed one on NSA surveillance. They had to approve all their decisions with Washington, D.C. So it was kind of like we were dealing with like a proxy. The Bush White House and Alberto Gonzalez and them, their office were really the ones that were involved in like all the big terrorism cases, which apparently ours was supposed to be a big terrorism case. I basically agreed to plead guilty to the conspiracy and the arson counts on the provision that they dropped a really serious 30-year mandatory. I had roughly 9 people willing to cooperate and testify against me, people that sat in a room and talked to the government for hours about myself and everyone else in the case, like everything, our likes, our dislikes, what we're like. I mean, just all kinds of stuff that's like really beyond the pale, beyond like our criminal conduct, but really who we are and like everything about us, which was obviously heartbreaking. It wasn't just the main informant at that point. It was like well-spoken, credible individuals who knew everything about me and knew some of my co-defendants. We had committed 15 different actions together. So I kind of knew that if I lost, if I went to trial with these 30-year mandatory charges, I would be like severely playing Russian roulette. And so I just decided that it made more sense for me to plead out. I was allowed to go to sentencing asking for 5 years, and they were allowed to ask for 9, and I guess the judge split the baby and I got 7. They found me guilty of the federal crime of terrorism enhancement, despite the fact that the incidents I was involved with didn't involve the government. It actually involved private corporations. And in fact, some of my co-defendants were found guilty of targeting the government in the form of the Bureau of Land Management, but they didn't get the terrorism enhancement, which is an interest in verbal gymnastics there, but on the part of my judge.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Join your friends and neighbors and become a member of this powerful radio community. I'm Ruben Lawrence, and I'm here with Jenna Yokoyama. Yes. This is our spring membership drive, and we're asking you to become a member today and help us make our goal of, I think it's $800?
$800 for this hour. We got 700 to go, so give us a call.
I'm going to give you the number right now. Call 877-500-5266, or if you want to remember it easily, 877-500-KBOO, or you can go online at kboo.fm and click the donate button.
So this interview, this is super interesting. I'm really, really glad that this is being featured today on KBOO News and Public Affairs Day. You know, KBOO decided to have this day in order to highlight all the amazing coverage that we bring you here on KBOO, where, you know, we're bringing you this local issue here about Daniel McGowan, you know, which is, we think of it as local, but it was actually quite a national issue. And one thing I've always found really interesting about, you know, the government likes to label as like environmental terrorism, you know, is how they decide to throw that word around terrorism.
Sometimes it seems
right?
kind of arbitrary.
Right, you know, and so it's interesting to get a chance to listen to this activist who has been at the heart of this government targeting and where this manipulative language is coming in and really shaping what are our environmental, you know, discussions that we're having, and look at what we're living in today as those consequences where people are shutting down those conversations and they say, oh wait, no, that's just terrorism, blah blah blah, you know, and that what these people are trying to highlight is not important. And you know, I know that this activist, you know, Daniel McGowan, is a controversial activist for many people, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't have the discussion. And that's what's so amazing about KBOO. And that's what I really preach about KBOO. And if you're tuned in right now, which you are, because you're listening to us, what's up, you know, You find this important. You find this discussion. And it's not just about environmentalism. It's not just about, oh, look at this, actually what it's doing. It's about taking an in-depth look at what it is to try to tackle an issue with a sense of passion and urgency. Because I don't know about you, Ruben, but have you been reading the environmental news? It's terrifying.
It's messy.
Let's give out that phone number again, because these are the discussions that we need to have in order to continue, saving our environment. So that's 877-500-5266. Again, that's 877-500-5266, or go online at kboo.fm. It only takes a couple minutes to sign up. We have some people who signed up. Ruben, why don't you let us know who have just joined us.
So we've got a couple of new members who've joined via the web. We have Rebecca in Salem.
Woo-hoo!
And Elizabeth in St. Helens. And I'm going to ring the cowbell.
More cowbell!
But I'm ringing it far away from the mic because I know some people find it a little bit loud.
We'll do it anyways. Thank you for joining us. So join Rebecca and join Elizabeth, you know, online, you know, people who are outside the Portland area, because, you know, we always have to remember that people are listening all across the state. They're listening across the nation. We get donations from everywhere because people really appreciate the type of programming and the depth of the programming that we hear bring you here at KBOO Community Radio.
Yeah, and Jenna, what you were talking about earlier about controversial stories, I love that. It's true. I think it's important to talk about controversial stories. A lot of times, things that make us a little bit uncomfortable or things that we're unsure about, those are the areas that we need to have the discussions in. So if you want to help us continue bringing these kind of stories and ideas and discussions to you, call us at 877-500-5266. 877-500-KBOO right now, or go online at kboo.fm and click the donate button.
You know, we would love to bring you all of our programming for free. You know, we have 500 volunteers that make KBOO run on a day-to-day basis. But
girl, that costs money.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah, it does. Because let me tell you, there's lights on 24 hours a day here. We have our transmitter. We have computers with internet. We have, you know, an air conditioning system. We have staff members that somehow manage all 500 of us to put up with us. You know, these are all the things that allow when you turn on your radio and all you're just, oh, you're like, oh, well, this is a really nice interview with Daniel McGowan. You know, it's all these little elements that make it possible. And it's our members, it's our sustaining members, especially, yes, that make it possible. Consider coming in at our $25 a month. That's $300 a year. And for $25 a month, you can get the amazing KBOO hoodies that you walk around Portland and show what you support, what you believe in, that you say, you know, I want the difficult discussions. I want the controversial discussions. Give us
a
call. Yes. 877-500-5266. 877-500-5266. We still have $700 to go left in this hour here on KBOO News and Public Affairs Day.
Yeah. Call us, donate online so that we can ring the cowbell.
KBOO.FM.
We can alternate between the cowbell and the desk bell.
And the bell. You know you want some cowbell behind your name. Give us a call. 877-500-5266. Again, 877-500-5266. And now back to that interview with Daniel McGowan.
We return to a speech by Daniel McGowan, recorded April 7th at Portland State University.
We coined the term green scare, and I don't mean to use that term because it's really not analogous to the red scare. I mean, what happened to people in the red scare is like no joke. No one was deported in the green scare. So it was never like a direct analogy, but it was sort of like this idea that we're in this community, we're doing this environmental activism, and people around us are like, you know, I mean, the Liberation Collective lost their 501c3. People getting like audited, grand juries, investigations, legislation specifically about that. Wise use groups like Ron Arnold and the Center for Consumer Freedom and the Center for the Defense of Free Enterprise, like, or there was one called Stop Eco-Violence. This woman named Kelly Stoner, who was just a timber industry lobbyist. It was just like this organized, this semi-organized effort to basically create this narrative that environmental activists are the number one domestic terror threat. When I say that, I can't get over it, but it's the words of Robert Mueller. It's the former FBI director got up there and said this. And when I was at Lane County and we got re-indicted, the feds like to do is they like to use the media really well. You get indicted, but then as soon as the rats in your case tell them more, they just work that into the narrative, and then they do a superseding indictment. And that's usually an opportunity for them to get more media. So on the days that they were going to have NSA wiretap motions, or NSA wiretap hearings, the first one, this is pre-Snowden, this is like 2006 when people first leaked the information that there were wiretaps from the NSA. That day is the day they announced our superseding indictment. I don't know, I'm in like my cell at Lane County and someone's like, hey, ELF. And I'm like, you know, resigned to the fact that that's what I'm going to be called. People don't care because they saw you. I saw you on the TV and you're ELF and that's that. But I come out to the day room. I'm like, what is he saying? And it's like, of course, like transcribed on the TV. And I'm like, having this moment where Alberto Gonzalez, like the attorney general, is talking about my case. That's kind of when I knew they were serious. If this is like small fry stuff, this is like vandalism. I mean, they have names for it, right? It's vandalism, it's arson, it's eco-sabotage, it's all this stuff. To call it terrorism, yeah, duh, that's what they call it. But at the time, like the idea that environmental activists would be called terrorists was just like, it was ludicrous. when they decide that you have a certain case that could garner any kind of attention from the media, they really like to bury you in the Midwest. And that's why all the supermax prisons and like a lot of the high security prisons or political units that they run are like deep in the middle of the Midwest, because so many of the people that are in federal prison are from the coast. So I spent my whole time in the Midwest, basically. So there's not much to say about Sandstone. It's your typical low security prison. It was full of men who crossed imaginary border lines between the U.S. and Mexico and got 3 to 7 years for felony reentry. A whole lot of men who sold crack and got crazy sentences because of a 100-to-1 ratio on crack versus cocaine, which is like largely predicated on race, and a remarkable amount of sex offenders. I played this weird game called pickleball, which is kind of like ping pong and tennis. It's like bizarre. It was a low security prison with weights. We had guitars, karaoke, you know, real country club, as they say. What was interesting was as I was being transferred out of Sandstone, which happened out of the blue, it was like in May, and I was just told to come down to the office and pack up my stuff. My experience in prison was every time I felt like I things were going okay for a split second, they went to ish pretty fast afterwards. So a few months later, I find myself at Marion. Marion is the second place that the BOP had a supermax prison. The first place was Alcatraz, and then Marion in the 60s to the 90s, and then they opened up the supermax prison at Florence, Colorado. But I show up at Marion. There's about 17 other men there. I have a friend of mine from New York was there, Andy Stepanian from the Shaq 7 case, and a smattering of people from like different discernible groups, but mostly Muslim men. The men there were mostly convicted of what's called material support of terrorism, which is the government claiming that their actions were somehow supporting, you know, Al-Qaeda, which, you know, it was only Al-Qaeda at the time. Now there's people that are accused of assisting ISIS in the CMU, apparently. And then there was a whole bunch of, like, entrapment cases. They even threw in... it's so crazy. Oh, look, the old Nazis playing with the Moorish Science Temple sovereign citizen. How does that like make sense in there? I would look at them and go, what are they thinking about the other person? Like it used to blow my mind. When I got there, we had no idea about any of the facts about the CMU. Nothing was like transparent. We had no idea how long we would be there, how to get out. We were told different things, 18 months, and then you get a transfer, or 24 months, and it was just really confusing. I reached out to a lot of different organizations, the ACLU, every prison group I can think of. Only really one was interested, which is the Center for Constitutional Rights. I say interested, but I mean like had the capacity to actually file suit. Really, I had a pre-existing relationship with them, and I was glad for that, but it was also kind of tragic that prisoners really have a hard time getting help from lawyers, and it's a structural problem. It's not like a problem on the part of the lawyers per se, but it's largely because of legislation that like restricted the ability of prisoners to file suits themselves, and for lawyers to actually make back any of the thousands of dollars that they spend fighting these pro se cases or these pro bono cases. So it's a real problem. But I got lucky, and I had help from the Center for Constitutional Rights. And we worked together for many months. I gave them all the information about the unit, like everything I possibly could get my hands on, any kind of thing they published, demographic information, trying to like make the strongest case. I wrote an article called Exposing Little Gitmo, which was our nickname for it. So we filed this lawsuit, and when the lawsuit was in draft, it was Aref, which is my co-plaintiff, not my co-defendant because we're suing the government, but it was Aref v. Mukasey, and we filed it as Aref v. Holder, because Eric Holder was the attorney general at that time. And now it's Aref v. Sessions, apparently, and it's 7 years old. We filed it on April 1st, 2010. The BOP definitely listened to our phone calls and our visits because they essentially tried to transfer people out of the unit the day before the lawsuit was filed, and they like came in on the morning the lawsuit was filed and posted these proposed regulations, which was part of our lawsuit. We were like essentially saying, you just opened up this unit without doing any of the due process, without doing any of the like fact finding or public comment that you're supposed to do when you open up, you know, when you open up a brand new communication management unit. You just can't do it. You have to like have this veneer of like democracy, and it's all fraudulent. A few months ago, we got a victory from the appellate court. It reinstated the lawsuit, sent it back to the judge. But I spent 26 months in the Marion CMU. I was released to general population, and I lasted there 4 months until they found a reason to send me back. And they sent me back to the Terre Haute CMU. And when I got there, I got a chance to see all the dudes that I knew that had been transferred from one to the other, because that's what the government did. They just switched co-defendants. Someone got in a fist fight thinking this might get me out of here. It just got them sent to the other CMU. So I walked in and I got razzed by a bunch of people who were like, "I can't believe you're back." And I was like, "What am I going to do?" And so I spent the remaining 21 months. To be honest, I met a lot of really interesting people there. A lot of people who were guilty just of being Muslim and having opinions that were critical of the United States government, or having pissed off like the Israeli government. Adam Hassoun, Kifa Jayusi, Yasin Aref, Ali Chandia, Hamid Hayat, Khalid Awan, Shukri Abu Baker, and the other Holy Land Foundation people. I learned a lot from these people, including how to handle a really bad situation while being or attempting to be kind and caring, which, to be honest, is one of the first things to be jettisoned when you're trying to survive. Like, there were times on visits, people were like, "You're not laughing anymore. You're not joking." And it like kind of hit me. I was like, I'm becoming a really serious person. I'm doing time with people that have 65-year sentences. I mean, and they are handling this, and they're coming by. They know I had a tough visit. They know things aren't going well, and they're coming by offering me like homemade baklava or whatever. I mean, guys used to cook like crazy in there and make really wonderful stuff. And I was always really enheartened by the people in the CMU. And this is during the Obama administration. I mean, I know people are like, I mean, I can't imagine anything good is going to come out of this current situation. But this CMU, this like these entrapment schemes, these different cases that you might have heard of or didn't hear of, this happened under Obama. And it's a really horrible part of that legacy, because he created the infrastructure that will without a doubt be used by Trump and the remaining future fascist presidents to do things horrible. I want to switch track and talk a little bit about where we find ourselves right now. So like the rise of the right wing, if you want to call it that, or white supremacists, is a really troubling trend. And I hate to say it, but I feel like it happened kind of under our noses, like during the Obama presidency and clearly before. I don't want to suggest that this is a current thing, because these people are always there. And like, I think we have a situation where people treat this like it's new, and it's not new. And it's just, there's this courage on the part of white supremacists now because they feel like they have numbers, or maybe they feel like they have their homies in the White House or whatever. You know, I have a lot of respect and appreciation for anti-racist action, ARA, the generation of punks that came before me that fought Nazis in the 80s and 90s. I remember hearing lots of stories. Talk about literal fights, I'm talking about other kinds of fights. I mean, there's just a bad history, big history of that. I never contributed much to this aspect of our movement. I think I like decided that ARA, I mean, I kept this to myself. I was never a hater, but ARA are like guys that want to fight Nazis. It's not that I found like the action's bad. I always supported them, but like other than calling clubs and getting like shows canceled, I just never really participated. I came into contact with white supremacists inside, and I never got into like horrible beef with them, but it was always like a tense situation that I had to consider at all times, like who I was around and stuff. This current moment has made me kind of look at like myself. Why didn't I take this that seriously? And you know, I have to be honest and be like, it has to, of course, have something to do with my identity, like who I am. Like, I'm a white cisgendered man. Like, I'm not going to be a victim of a hate attack. I'm not going to get targeted. I'm like, there's a whole bunch of things that won't happen. I can hear stories about horrible things that happen. I read a lot of history. But like, it just killed me that it took a Trump presidency for me to like take this seriously. And so I don't think it's just me, and I don't leave this as an indictment. I think this is a large part of the left. I mean, these folks didn't come out of nowhere, and I'm sure there's people in this room that have dealt with this issue for many years. There's no secret that they exist. They exist where I grew up in New York. They exist in Oregon. Obviously, Oregon's history is wrought with it. I mean, we're in Portland. I'm sure people know about the horrible killing of Mulugeta Sarah by white supremacists. If you don't know about that, 100 Little Hitlers is a really excellent book to read about that particular incident. So, and I, you know, I was in Eugene, and like we, you know, there were skinheads in Eugene in the 90s and 2000s, and maybe now. But I was in prison when this case happened in the Midwest, and it really made me think twice about this. It was called the Tinley Park Five case. Probably 20 anti-fascists broke up a meeting that was called like a white cultural gathering. It was essentially promoted by a bunch of Hammerskins, a pretty violent group of skinheads, if you don't know. They broke up this meeting, and by broke up, I mean they stormed in, beat the hell out of people, destroyed everything, and ran out. And the people that I knew in prison that I would talk to about different things were like, yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that's what you do, right? Well, what else are you going to do? Are you going to talk to them about, like, you know, why they're horrible? I mean, they're talking about genocide and stuff. And in 2013, when they got out, like, one after another, I don't think I've ever dealt with a situation that was harder to fundraise for. Nobody claimed them. The left was not with them. I mean, I got into arguments with radical lawyers and otherwise that were like, yeah, I'm not really into that. That's adventuristic. But they were like known skinheads, known violent dudes. And so I was really disappointed. I was like trying to fundraise for dudes coming home. You know, they were in Illinois State Prison having a hard time because that place is rampant with white supremacists. And it really shocked me at the time. And it started making me think of like how important that work was. If we fast forward to where we are right now, we have people that are perceived as non-American by these boneheads are being attacked really on all levels. I mean, the governmental level, from, you know, specific incidents, travel bans in New York, which they like to call a sanctuary city, which I would just say, let's just retire that term because that doesn't mean anything. There's no kind of sanctuary. In New York City, people get arrested for jumping the turnstile more than anything. And when you get arrested, like, and you go to Rikers or you don't go to Rikers, you still have to deal with the fact that these federal agents are in the courthouse. I definitely know they're in Multnomah County because I read about it online all the time on Facebook. People like ICE agents are at Multnomah County courthouse and they're there to basically troll and just pull people. In New York, we have these morons calling themselves Proud Boys. They're basically just like gussied up men's rights activists with like hints of like Islamophobia, misogyny, and sort of like this fanboy thing for their leader. Their leader happens to be a former Vice magazine co-founder, a Canadian immigrant, mind you, named Gavin McInnes. They are toxic, and this situation we find ourselves in has given them like chutzpah, like guts. So I take these people at their word. I think a lot of this liberal backlash, this free speech defense stuff needs to be like totally destroyed. Like, take them at their word. Do you take yourself seriously? When you say something, do you mean it? Because these people mean it. So I follow the situation. I was on probation for 3 years and I was like on eggshells. So I've just been like very observing, reading as much as I can, following. You know, I think lately, it's interesting. I have not been involved in environmental work for some time, but people will, because of my past, be like, oh, you're an environmentalist. And I'm like, I always feel like I'm not trying to front. Like, I don't really do environmental stuff. It's not that I don't think it's important. It's just sometimes I think we don't really get to pick always what we work on. Like, things end up in our laps. I mean, I have friends that like were on a particular path and I fell and their lives went like that. I mean, timeouts on grad school and all kinds of stuff. I have like a support. My support crew is like 6 to 8 people that just devoted their 8 years, 9 years. Like, when we finally disbanded, it was such like a pleasure for me to be like, thank you. This is over, right? I'm out. I'm good. But so we don't get to pick always what, you know, sometimes it literally is like what's needed. What is needed right now? And who are you? And what is your relationship? And what could you contribute?
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio during our spring membership drive. I am Jenna, and I am here with Ruben. And why don't you give us a call right now, 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266. You're listening to a speech from activist Daniel McGowan. And we want to just give a quick thank you to Mark from Northwest Portland. Woohoo! Let's give him some cowbell. Okay. We promised him cowbell.
There we go.
And Mark is a returning member. We love that. People who used to be members of KBOO and you know, he literally called in because of this speech that he's listening to right now, because he said, you know, this is the type of stuff I want to hear on KBOO, who said, play more of this kind of stuff. So thank you very much to Mark. Join Mark in showing where you want your dollars to go to, because let's face it, you could keep your money in a bank, which is good, you know, if you have.
Or you could give it to us.
Or you can give it to us. If you have, say, like $5 a month, $5 a month. If you can come in at the $5 a month, you know, you could either keep that in the bank and give the bank money and make them money, or you can invest it into something like KBOO. You're going to be investing that $5 one way or another. Why not invest it into this radio station, to this program you're you're listening
to. It totally
to.
Is an investment. It absolutely. In addition to the amazing programming we have, it's completely volunteer run. And the training that we offer our volunteers is excellent. It's very high caliber, mm-hmm. very high quality. And I've just been volunteering for KBOO for about a month and a half. So I'm relatively new, but I absolutely love it. It's been such a great thing that I've added to my life. So call us. And maybe start off with just doing $5 a month. You can call us at 877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO, or go online at kboo.fm and click the donate button.
You know, when you think of $5 a month, that comes out to $60 a year. When I think of $5 is like a really fancy 3,000 calorie Frappuccino, or it's a decently sized burrito, or it's not even a movie ticket anymore. It's not even a matinee. Oh, it's so sad. But, you know, so if you think, okay, if I could do one burrito a month for KBOO, I could do that. I have to admit that, you know, if, to me, this type of programming is worth the one burrito a month. So if you can come in at $5 a month, consider it. Give us a call, 877-500-5266. That's 877-500-5266. Become a sustaining member of KBOO so you can sustain the type of program you're listening to. Where else are you literally going to hear an interview that makes you go, wow, this is really fascinating and also makes me kind of uncomfortable?
Yeah.
That's KBOO like every day. And if you're like me, you love that. So 877-500-5266 or go online to kboo.fm. We have volunteers waiting to take your call. We still have about $600 to go in this hour. Take advantage and just show where you want your dollars to go. Become a member today.
We return to a speech by Daniel McGowan.
Few people that got arrested at the inauguration in DC. And so I'm sitting home and a bunch of these people got arrested and they're facing like 10 years in federal prison because when you're in DC, you're under federal law. And so they got arrested for rioting. And the blowback has been really bad. It appears that what happened is like one of the DC police gave a spreadsheet of information about the defendants to a compatriot of Richard Spencer. So this person at Radix Magazine essentially just took the names and then found everyone on Twitter, found everyone on Facebook, and just started tweeting like crazy, like their pictures, and with all this kind of anti-Semitic nonsense, like, look, another Jew from New York, and like all this disgusting stuff, like phone numbers and employers and like a few of my friends. And so my signal was going off the hook, like, yo, report these people. And I'm just like trying to mobilize. And I'm sitting there like reporting people, which felt weird at first. You know, I was like, is this snitching? You know what, it's not. And so I'm reporting and blocking and calling people and like, yo, and finally, you know, we get it done. And yet I gotta say, it feels gross. I don't really engage them much with the ideas because I don't actually think that I'm gonna convince them of anything. But it feels gross, and yet I don't think that really matters. Some of what we have to do might feel gross. I mean, without pushback, Milo and David Horowitz would have sat there and named like a bunch of undocumented, pulled like a real McCarthy thing. Like, we have a list here of undocumented students at UC Berkeley. A list, if I'm reading that, then what I'm essentially saying is I'm telling like these like Gamergate dudes to like go attack them. They're other and you should go get them. And so, you know, when people wring their hands, and I don't think people in this room necessarily wring their hands, but I'm sure your parents do, and I'm sure like my sister does, seeing like what happened in Berkeley, you have to like ask yourself, well, what's the consequences of doing nothing? And without the pushback, what happens? So it's hard to like quantify our victories, but I think we need to like understand, like, without obstruction, what happens? People's names get read out. People fear walking down the street or going on the subway. Little kids get told to go back home. I don't really care where anyone's born from, so I don't care if they're from here or not, but little children being told to go back to Mexico, go back here, go back there, hijabs getting ripped off people's heads, like, that sort of stuff is, you know, it feels like finger in the dike approach. But if we're not, if we're not obstructing this, if we're not using the relative privilege that a lot of us perhaps have, then, you know, it's a disservice to marginalized communities. And I say this, you know, with a sense of being in it, like I am like deep in this process of thought. I don't have actual answers of what we're supposed to do, but I do know that we have to like be engaging on these topics. I'm sometimes dumbfounded by like I have all this interest in Antifa stuff and anti-fascist stuff, and it's never been an issue. But like honestly, the world we're facing right now is messed up. I had a really bad November. The election was horrible, so most people did. I had like a really debilitating sense of like being knocked off my feet. Like I just did not know what to do. I had about a week and a half of this like dread that just wouldn't leave me, and it was largely based on like things I care about, people I care about, populations that I have, you know, empathy for, Standing Rock. Like there was just all these, you know, horror show, parade of horrors. Like a week into it, it kind of hit me. Like I was talking to my sister, and she was like, "Well, what does this mean for you?" Oh my God, like I'm a convicted terrorist under the Trump administration. Like there's like 500 people convicted of so-called terrorist crimes in the US. What really pulled me out of it was just the fact that all over the country, people were like starting to like really pull themselves out of this like existential dread, this like paralysis of like the first weeks, and like really go for it. And I, like most people, made the mistake. I was like, oh, we're gonna have like this really familiar enemy for the next 4 years, Clinton. Trump, you know, it's a new thing. I think for some people, shutting down these like fascist events that are happening all over the country is a good focus. And for other people, it's going to be building up our power so we can effectively out-organize them. But in terms of what we're doing, what we end up doing, I think it's important to note, you know, with any engagement with the state or against white supremacists, there's consequences, often, you know, legal, but also medical, as we saw with Hex being shot in Seattle, that are really seriously. Do people know that in Sacramento in June 26th mobilization, 9 people got stabbed and sent to the hospital. And this was the mobilization against, I believe, what they're calling themselves is the Traditional Workers Party, Matthew Hamback, I believe. And, you know, they showed up and they were outnumbered. And when there were fights, you know, our side whooped them, but they stabbed 9 people. And like, we're not talking like slash marks, so like serious wounds in people's abdomens that required like thousands of dollars in care. And then recently, I don't know if people know, but the California Highway Patrol, CHIPS, I guess, which just cracks me up when I saw that. I was like, what? Suggested like 500 indictments for misdemeanor and felony cases for events stemming out of June 26. I mean, 473 indictments. So, you know, obviously they've been talking to the right wing. The left has not been talking. I mean, they've been calling people. They've been calling all the people that got stabbed. Nobody's talking to them, but they've talked to the right. And so I'm sure the right's got no compunction against snitching. I don't even think they care. And so, you know, we're looking at a situation where like California indictments are essentially going to roll out. And so we need to have people's backs. I mean, I'm an individual that essentially benefited from a tremendous amount of support. And so I think like when we're talking about anti-fascist stuff or all the resistance against Trump, we have to be there for people that fall, whether that's medically or legally.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio. Join your friends, neighbors, and become a member of our powerful radio community. I'm Ruben Lawrence, and I'm here with Jenna Yokoyama, and this is our spring membership drive. We're asking you to become a member today and help us make our goal of
$800? $800 an hour. We still have $540
so
left
down
to go. Give us a call.
877-500-5266, 877-500-KBOO, or go online at kboo.fm and click the donate button.
So we're getting kind of like, I don't know, we're in the like heart of this lecture being done by Daniel McGowan. And, you know, if you're new to the Portland area in the kind of last few years, because we know that, you know, Portland has had an explosion of people moving here, you might not be too familiar with him. And it's, you know, KBOO is bringing you this interview, or what do we want to call it, a speech, in order to educate, you know, to show you what your local issues are and also how our local issues actually make the national stage, you know. It's so important to constantly bring these conversations back up, to re-educate ourselves, to remind ourselves
Absolutely.
How these stories evolve over time, you know, because when all this was happening with Daniel McGowan, the story he's talking about, you know, all his quote-unquote terrorism started way back in the early 2000s. And, you know, he was only released from prison just a few years ago. It's how much he's grown, how much he's learned. And, you know, just getting this perspective that you're not going to get this anywhere on the mainstream media, right? So because you appreciate this level of perspective, because you want this level of coverage from someone who, you know, understands Oregonians' issues, give us a call. Become a member. Show us how this is what's important to you. 877-500-5266. Consider coming in at around our $20 a month. And you know, if that comes out to, what is it? It's math. That's $240. Wow, $240 a year. If you can come in at the $20 a month, you know, you can take a thank you gift with you. We have speech by Chris Hedges on Friday, May 26th. The doors open at 6 o'clock there at the Aladdin. And, you know, if you drive by there right now, I drove by there today, and I love it. On the billboard, it just says, "Stop Fascism, May 26th and 27th. So you can get tickets for Chris Hedges, or on Saturday, May 27th, there's that Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco conversation where they're literally going to talk about stopping fascism, because we're Portland, and unfortunately, we have to have that conversation.
So yeah, give us a call at 877-500-5266, 877-500-KABU, or go online at kabu.fm and click the donate button. And actually, speaking of Chris Hedges, so the two shows next Friday and Saturday, if you can get those for a $20 a month donation, the whole theme is stop fascism. And I actually did not know that much about Chris Hedges. And yesterday I just learned that he is a Pulitzer Prize winning journalist and Princeton professor. And Joe Sacco is a, he is a political cartoonist and journalist. Mm-hmm. So two very interesting, thoughtful people with a lot to say. And I actually just got handed a little note from one of our volunteers. Ooh. Who's answering phones. We want to thank Jessica from Southeast Portland. Woo-hoo. Jessica listens to KABU every day and loves the diversity programming we
thank
offer
you,
here.
Thank you, Jessica.
Be like Jessica calling 877-500-5266. 877-500-KABU. Or go online at kabu.fm and click the donate button.
You know, in addition to being a volunteer here at KABU, I'm also a listener of KABU. I will say that my dial doesn't move much. And the reason that I'm able to tune into KABU all the time is because I love the, you know, as Jessica was saying, the diversity of programming. You know, when you tuned in today, it's amazing everything you're going to hear on this news and public affairs day, all the different perspectives, all the different stories, you know, that are local and national, international. And there's never a shortage of interesting stories being told here on KABU.
There's always something.
Yeah, and I mean, there's some shows that I want to yell at, but then it's because it's making me think, and that's what I want, and that's what you appreciate.
And that's the diversity of our program.
Exactly. So 877-500-5266. Consider coming in at that $20 a month. You can pick up those Chris Hedges tickets. 877-500-5266. We're just about $500 away from our goal for the hour, and it's our last pitch break here, so give us a call. Become a member today. Show everybody where you want your media, where you want your democracy to be here in Portland, in your Oregon, wherever you are. Maybe you're listening on kabu.fm. Become a member today, 877-500-5266.
Daniel McGowan now speaks about his current focus.
Since like 2012, I was released from prison. I was in the halfway house for 6 months, and I went home. I got arrested for like a day for writing an article for the Huffington Post. That was really ridiculous. My focus is building support for political prisoners in the U.S. To say that I was the beneficiary of like a silly amount of support would be an understatement. I mean, I more so than most people received like a tremendous amount of movement support. I'm like eternally grateful for it. It's kind of hard not to talk about it, but I had like a really amazing support crew. They kept me with books and visits and money and paid rent and, you know, did so many things and so many like t-shirts and bake sales and benefits and like helping out my co-defendants and everything. You know, it's a bit like that lifelong debt that I feel, you know, not necessarily, not only to those people, but to the movement. I mean, if the movement is there for you, you know, I think that it gives people a sense of knowing that we're in this together, that if you fall, you're not just going to be forgotten, because there's nothing like prison to make you feel that you're gone. I mean, my first day I was arrested, they led me down this hallway that I thought would never end. And, you know, they slammed the door and you just think like, that's it. And I'm like really well aware of the good people in my life, and yet you put me in that situation, I have to like tell myself like, they know you're here. Like, people know it's on the computer. You're not forgotten about. But that everything about the surrounding of prison is designed to dissociate you from that, to separate you and kill it. I always felt I was really lucky. I had a 7-year sentence. It's determinate. It wasn't like a 7 to 10 with parole, with chance. So I was, you know, I didn't have an appeal. So I never had that period of time of like constantly waiting for the bad news or the good news. So when I came home, I decided I wanted to help. And so I do a lot of support for men from movements that I have a lot of respect for, like the Black Panther Party or the anti-imperialist movement of the 60s, 70s, and 80s. People like Herman Bell and Jahlil Muntakim, David Gilbert, Robert Seth Hayes. I work in a collective called Certain Days, which produces a calendar every year. It's like an educational thing, but it's also a fundraiser, because we then take the money that we raise, which is usually, you know, thousands of dollars, and we give that back basically to groups that do solid work with prisoners, that that really like put prisoners at the forefront of what they're doing. I think a lot of what happens in this country on the prison level happens on the state level, and so there's no reason to think that, in addition to all this like reactive defensive stuff we're doing, that we should continue to push forward. You know, they say the bad thing about every state is that it has a prison system and federal prisons. There's no shortage of like areas to work on, and obviously no shortage of work to be done. In the grand scheme of things, where we're talking about political prisoners, we're talking about people from our movements, but it's a small amount of people. And obviously the prison system in the United States is like 2.3 million, 1.6 in prison, 700,000 in jails, and you got all the ICE and military prisons. And I mean, it's an enormous amount. And so obviously my idea is never that we would just engage in this tiny group of people, but we find like commonality between our struggles. I want to thank everyone for coming. I want to thank Rad EDU, Amanda and Justin, Esther. Thank you.
That was a speech by Daniel McGowan. It was recorded April 7th, 2017 at Portland State University Smith Center. The unedited speech can be heard on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. This was recorded, edited, and produced by Aaron Yankee for KBOO Portland. Thanks for listening.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 2:59. Coming up next on KBOO, a talk by Hank Willis Thomas, an African-American visual artist, photographer, and arts educator. And we'd like to take this opportunity to again thank KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate, or by calling 877-500-5266.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to host Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco on Saturday, May 27th at 2 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Journalist Chris Hedges and award-winning cartoonist Joe Sacco wrote the best-selling book, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, together. Their talk includes a discussion about sacrifice zones, areas in America that have been offered up for exploitation in the name of profit, progress, and technological advancement. Again, that's Chris Hedges and Joe Sacco, Saturday, May 27th at 2 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hank Willis Thomas is a photoconceptual artist who creates work focused on themes of identity, race, media, and popular culture. He recently spoke at Oregon State University, and KBOO was there. And now, here's Hank Willis Thomas.
Thank you so much. I'm going to start with just a clip from a 5-channel video installation that I did in the work of James Baldwin. It's called The Person Who's More Important Than Anything Else.
It seems to me that the honest struggle